Our guest today for this first edition of the Remarkable People interview series is James Altucher, a man who has been to the top of the mountain more than once, fallen to the bottom of the deepest canyons, only to rise again, and he's done it at least twice that I know of. James is the author of 5 best-selling books, including his current blockbuster bestseller, one of my personal all-time favorites, Choose Yourself. James, it's great to have you with us today.
And Robert, it's really an honor to be on your show. I'm really happy to be here, and I've always been enjoying your books and writings.
Let's start out by asking you this question. One of the endless number of places where you go against the grain is when you say that the quest for a single purpose has ruined many lives. Why don't you shed some light on why you feel that way?
Sure. I think, you know, think of the type of purpose that many people have, like, oh, I want to have $100 million, or I want to be a Hollywood movie star, or I want to have sex with the most beautiful girl in the world, or whatever. You know, all of the, and, you know, even if you take those goals down a few notches, many of these goals are just setting you up for unhappiness. So it's as if you're saying, I'm unhappy now, but happiness can be found over there. But you can't be happy over there unless you first learn how to be happy over here, where you are right now. And you need to learn to be, or I say this for myself, I always needed to learn to be grateful and happy with what I have now, as opposed to always looking for some other place. Because so many people say to me, oh, I don't know what my purpose in life is. You know, nobody, the idea that we're supposed to have a purpose in life is a story. It's not reality. Like, the reality is what you have right now and what you can do right now to kind of better yourself and improve your situation. So right now is my purpose in life. I have to figure out where I am and how I can be happier. The times when I've had goals, like, let's say I had $10 million and I tried to have $100 million. Well, A, guaranteed I'm going to be unhappy, even though I had $10 million. And B, it's almost a guarantee I'm going to lose the $10 million and end up with zero, which is exactly what happened. So having goals and so-called purpose are these fictional stories we tell ourselves because we're unhappy, and that almost is a guarantee we're even going to be more unhappy.
You know, you mentioned Woody Allen a lot, and I think we both relate to him because I guess at the end of the day we're kind of all tortoises, or what I like to call anti-heroes, like Dustin Hoffman in the Graduate. And I don't remember the exact quote, I don't have it in front of me, but Woody Allen said something about happiness isn't getting what you want, happiness is wanting what you already have. And I think that's very much what you're talking about.
Exactly. Like, you know, most people, I get a lot of letters like, oh, I'm feeling stuck, I don't know what to do, should I move to a new city, you know, and the reality is my answer is you always have to just take a step back, take a deep breath, and just focus on things you can do to be happy right now. Are you eating well? Are you sleeping well? Are you surrounding yourself with people who love you? Are you grateful? Are you working on coming up with ideas and exercising your creativity muscle? Like, these are the things I can do right now to make myself happier. And then, if I'm happy right now, I don't have to worry so much about the future. The future is going to happen whether I want it to or not. So the only thing I can focus on is right now.
You know, you talk a lot about getting rid of your grudges, and that's a big, big thing with a lot of people, including me, because they really can imprison you. Can you give us 2 or 3 specific ways that people can make progress in this area?
Yeah, I think the main thing is, you know, and you've discussed this before in some of your writing, but my mistakes are my mistakes. Sometimes I've let people fool me, but in retrospect, I can easily see if I had recognized these cues, or if I had, you know, taken responsibility for my own actions, I would not have made the mistakes I made. It was never anybody else's fault. I can't blame anybody else. And in fact, blame takes a lot of energy in the brain. I need to use my brain for other things right now. So if I'm putting the energy, you know, my hard-earned energy into blaming others or being angry at others or thinking, why did this person do this to me or why did she act this way, I'm only going to take energy that I could be using to better myself. So I always, it's an exercise, it's a daily exercise. I wake up every day blaming someone else for something or being angry at somebody. But it's the first exercise of the day is to come back to where I am and say, look, this is my life, nobody else's life, and I've got to take care of it starting from this point on.
So you definitely know how to look in the mirror, and that's good. That's very healthy. What would you say to someone who works for corporate America and says, I agree with you that it sucks, but I have to do it until I get myself in a financial position to go out on my own?
Well, two things. One is they're never going to get into a financial position to go out on their own if they work for corporate America. Corporate America, just almost by definition, they have to do this. They have to keep you on a tight leash. So they can't pay you enough so that you are bold for freedom. Like if you're really good, they're going to just tie you on a leash more. So what you have to do, unfortunately, if you're in corporate America, is, you know, if you're going to hold on to your job, you have to start thinking of businesses and ideas and income streams you can develop on the side right now. So that's what I did. The only way I was able to break free from corporate America was I launched an entire business on the side. And in some ways, I was almost competing with myself at my job in corporate America. But no one is looking out for you except for you. Your boss doesn't care about you, and his boss doesn't care about him, and it all comes down from the top. So everybody wants your time. Everybody values what they're getting from you, but no one is going to let you escape unless you escape. So what I would suggest to someone is start exercising your idea muscle. Come up with 10 ideas a day. Do this for 6 months. Eventually you're going to have ideas that will start to generate income for you and, you know, start to launch yourself into passive income streams on the side or a business on the side. Eventually you'll be able to quit. And that's what I did.
I like something Warren Buffett said on this. He said, I always worry about people who say, I'm going to do this for 10 years. I don't really like it too well, and then I'll do this. He said, that's a little like saving up sex for your old age, not a very good idea.
Exactly. Like I was talking to someone yesterday who has a job but also actually makes a decent income on the side writing books. And he was thinking maybe in 2 or 3 years he could save up enough to, you know, just do the writing full time. And meanwhile, we were brainstorming. He could do 15 different ideas right now that would replace his income on his job. No problem. But there's a fear component. Again, we grow up being told stories by our parents, by our friends, by our teachers, by the government. And part of the stories that America in, you know, essentially since the Industrial Revolution has grown up with is that working for a big corporation is safe, is a guarantee of some degree of freedom when you're older. And this is just not a true story. It's a fiction. And the only reality is that we're here in this body and we've got to survive. Everything else is a fiction. So you have to kind of use discernment to determine, is this a fiction that's going to harm me, or can I get around this story and make my own story? I can choose myself, as my book calls it. And you're right. People are afraid to make their own story. They want to believe. It's very hard to break free from the stories that we've been told by all of our peers.
I also like the fact that you've learned to say no to most things. I have a sign on my wall that says, learn to say no politely and pleasantly, but immediately and firmly. Don't you find it to be a high when you muster up the strength to tell somebody straight out, without equivocation, no?
Yeah, and it's very hard to do. Like, why is no hard to do? It's potentially can result in an argument. Potentially you can hurt someone's feelings. You know, most people are people pleasers. They don't like to say no. Most people like to say yes. There's plenty of books out there that say yes all the time. So, again, it's part of our mythology of life right now that we should be yes people instead of no people. And you shouldn't be so negative. But the reality is life is pretty hard, and if you take care of yourself first and say no to all the storytelling that happens in your life, then that's a guarantee you're going to be happier right now.
You know, Harry Brown, through his landmark book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, taught me the importance of being your true self. In fact, had I not acted on his advice, I don't think I would have had a chance when I met my wife at a party where everyone else was trying so hard to be L.A. cool. I lived in L.A. at the time, and I tell the story in one or two of my books. And it never would have happened because, as Harry Brown said, she wouldn't have recognized me for who I really was if I was trying to be like everybody else. What prompted you, James, to refuse to wear a mask, and how long did it take you to get good at being yourself?
Well, I think the first prompting for me was that I sold my first company, I made a lot of money, and then I just messed up in every possible way you could imagine messing up. You know, in the search for all the fake goals of, you know, wealth, fame, power, sex, all of these things have time bombs in them that can destroy you. And I probably stepped on every single mine that could possibly destroy me. And I ended up totally dead broke and losing my home, no job, no source of income, huge debts. And nobody was going to take care of me. All the people who used to return my calls all the time, they would not speak to me at all. Nobody was my friend anymore. And I had to kind of step up and reinvent myself. And then I had to do it again. I built myself back up. I built another company. I sold it. And then again, a similar thing happened. Exact same story, except this time now I was getting a divorce, losing my home, losing all my money, losing all my friends, losing all my income streams. And finally I was like, you know what? I don't care anymore. I'm not going to deal with anybody who holds out a carrot to me. I'm going to hunt and kill for my own food and not depend on anything else. I don't care what anybody thinks about me. The only person that's important to me right now is me, because then I'll be able to take care of the people who actually love me and the people who love them, and so on. It ripples out like a stone dropped in the ocean, but I'm the stone. I'm the one that has to start the ripple. Otherwise, I'll sink.
Boy, that's great. It's almost right out of How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, and the book that really opened my eyes to that whole thing. You know, you make a great point about hating to beg people to say yes, which is really very much related to what you're talking about. What do you say to the person who uses the excuse that he's in such a bad position that he has no choice but to press someone hard to say yes?
You know, there's always a choice. And the way you do it is through diversification of the people you want to have say yes. So you know this from the LA world. Like, I was pitching a TV show once, and I felt like my whole life depended on, you know, one insane person saying yes to me. We're going to green light your TV show. And it was so painful because that was the only thing I had going on. And every day I was just waiting by the phone. Is this person going to call me and say yes? And I swore to myself afterwards I was never going to have that feeling again. Now, of course, I've had that feeling many times since then. But, you know, my goal now, or my secret now, is always diversify through industry, through ideas, through whatever, the number of people who you would be happy if they said yes to you. So like right now, let's say I have 30 things going on. I don't need all 30 people to say yes to me. Maybe one or two people will say yes to me on whatever ideas I have. That's always the case. You went through quantity here as well as quality.
You know, I've written a lot about you always have a choice. When people say, I had to do it, I didn't have a choice, or I have no choice, I've got to do it. And I know it's easier said than done, but I always tell people, you're totally wrong. You always have a choice. You may not like the other choice, but you do always have a choice in life, no matter who it is. I think it was Ayn Rand who said, you may need a deal, but you don't need any one deal. You may need a person, but you don't need any one person. And it's true. You know, it's kind of the thing about girls and guys. There's always plenty of fish in the sea. And that just happens to be a truism about life that is really axiomatic. To deny it is foolish.
Right. Like, you know, there's 7 billion people on the planet. There's $15 trillion floating around the U.S. economy. So whatever you think about the economy and whatever you think about the government, they almost don't matter. Like, I never let the government be involved in any decision of mine. But I know that there's $15 trillion out there. So some of that money belongs to me if I have enough ideas and I pursue enough things to get my piece of the pie. Now, it might not happen tomorrow. I might not get an envelope in the mail with money in it tomorrow. But I always have the choice to pursue more things and to have more ideas and to be creative and to not just rely on one person or one situation to work out for me. Because that's the key to unhappiness. If you're waiting for the one person to say yes, and then you'll be happy, else you'll be unhappy, then more often than not, you're going to be unhappy.
You and I both have had great success in our lives when it comes to making a lot of money, then finding amazing ways to spend more than we made. And with all you've been through, what advice would you give to people who always seem to find ways to spend more money than they make?
Well, I think the key is to really lower your expectations. Now, this doesn't mean settle. You know, this doesn't mean buy worse things or settle for less in life. In fact, what happens when you lower your expectations is that you're guaranteed to always exceed them. So I'm always exceeding my expectations, but I surrender to the fact that I don't really need to buy an airplane or a yacht or whatever. If those things are meant to happen, they'll happen, whatever. But I'm always very happy with where I am in my life, at least right now. And this makes it that I don't go out necessarily looking for ways to spend my money, because cash buys you one thing, which is freedom. I don't want to work for a corporation. That's the only thing I want to buy with my cash. So the other uses for my cash is to make sure I always have that freedom. So I recycle the cash in what I think are good, well-resourced investments and diverse and so on. And part of that is from experience. I know a little bit about what bad investments are and what really bad investments are. And part of that is diversification. And part of that is making sure I always have enough cash in the bank. So the only thing I want is my own personal freedom. Everything else, I don't need anything else. I don't need an extra 6 houses. In fact, I don't believe anybody should buy a house and then you owe money to the government, to the banks, and so on. I don't need to worry about. I don't believe in today's system of college education. I think that's another example of storytelling where corporations tell you need a degree in order to be happy. So I'm not too worried about sending my kids to college for, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, whatever it costs by the time they're old enough. So I always keep my expectations very low. I always exceed them, and I'm always focused on cash should be used for freedom and relatively little else.
You and I are both entrepreneurs, but most people say they have no idea how to go out there and just start a company. What do you believe is the number one trait it takes to be an entrepreneur?
You know, it's scary being an entrepreneur. Like, to make that leap, we're so imprisoned by, again, this storytelling. It's hard to choose ourselves. We want General Motors to choose us and say, yes, you're good enough to be hired by us. Or we want a big bank to choose us and say, yes, we'll hire you. So it's hard to choose ourselves because then you're just all by yourself. You're the only one choosing yourself if you choose yourself. So the hardest thing is to say, look, I'm going to go out there and I'm good enough to do some idea. And I'm also good enough to fail and come back because I'm going to fail quite a bit. So the one thing they don't teach in 20 years of educational system is how to fail and how to be persistent. As soon as you walk in a classroom these days, they start giving you A pluses. But the real world is not like a bunch of stickers and A pluses. The real world is about a bunch of Fs, and every once in a while you get a C, and even more rarely you get an A. So you always have to be persistent and be willing to accept that. That's going to happen if you're an entrepreneur. If you're choosing yourself, it's difficult. Life is difficult. The real world is difficult.
Yeah, it's amazing how so many people almost act like they're insulted because something didn't work out or somebody screwed them in a deal or they failed or whatever. As you say, I mean, that's life. The way you put it is, I think you said in your book, I don't know whether it was an exaggeration, you failed at 17 of the last 18 businesses or something.
Yeah.
I always like to say that failure is just an ongoing process in life, and the only question is what the individual does about it. It's their attitude toward it.
Right, and it's very hard. Like, failure is very painful. Like, you don't like to put energy into something and then lose. So, you know, part of it also is, you know, understanding what things you can choose not to do because you're just going to set yourself up for failure. Like, if I try to say I'm going to win the New York Marathon, well, that's useless. So I'm just going to be unhappy. But I can say, well, I have an idea I can outsource my idea to software developers. I could build it and I could see what happens. And I could send some advertising dollars and see what happens. And I can keep costs down every step of the way. But I'm not just going to do that idea. I'm going to do five other ideas and see which starts to work. Or I can say, I have some ideas for potential customers. I can call up the customers and say, would you like it if I did these ideas for you? And if they say yes, I could say, well, can you pay up front? So not everybody's going to say yes to me. But if, again, if I approach 30 people with good ideas, one person says yes and we do a deal. And that's how you mitigate the risk of failure in entrepreneurship, but there's always going to be failure.
It's called the law of averages. Now, I think Woody Allen said that 80 or 90% of success is showing up. And in one of my books, I said something like 95% of success is a matter of asking. And I give my 10 rules of success. Number one, ask. Number two, ask again. Number three, ask again. Number four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, and 10, ask again and again and again. It's called the law of averages, and I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and Woody Allen's a great example. Like, he went through, you know, a horrific social and career scandal, I guess it was about 20 years ago, and did he stop? Did he give up? Did he cry himself to sleep? Maybe he did for a moment or two, but since then he's done a movie a year, and some of his greatest movies ever have come about since then. So this is a guy who keeps showing up and keeps, you know, when he has a bad movie, which he often does, he just does the next movie. Like, life's too short to spend the rest of it, you know, crying about all of our bad stuff when there's so much good things that can happen.
A couple of great things you said. First, how important do you think it is to not spend a lot of time trying to change people's minds?
Oh, you know, how many times have all of us spent arguing politics with people? So, you know, whether it's pro-guns or anti-guns or pro-global warming or anti-global warming or whatever you're pro and against, there are so many polarizing issues. No one's ever going to change their mind. I never try to change anybody's mind on anything. They'll never do it. And I'm fine with that. Like, like a lot of people on both sides of every political fence, it has nothing to do with whether their morals or their capacity to be friends or whatever. You know, but I could tell you for sure, nobody's going to change their mind. Nobody's going to change their habits. Like, how many times have you had somebody call you up and say, oh, my boyfriend or my girlfriend, she's cheating on me. What should I do? And you say, well, of course, you should break up with her. Do they ever listen to you? No. They 99.999% will never listen to you, and you're going to get the same call 1 month later and 6 months later. So from the same person. So people don't change their minds, and they don't change their habits. So you just have to cope with that and live your life accordingly.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes directly from your book, and I think it's what you're talking about, is, I don't need to have so many opinions. The fight will continue with or without me. And isn't it true? All the people in the political arena and on television, they die, but it's like nothing ever changes. The fight goes on, and nothing ever changes. It reminds me of the serenity prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's really what I think you're talking
right.
about.
And it's funny, it's very funny you brought it up. My wife and I were talking about that exact prayer this morning because it's a very good example of saying no to the things you can't change. And it's very important to have discernment, you know, which is also in the prayer, to know which things you can't change. And almost everything outside of yourself, you can't change. So look at the news. You know, the news, I don't look at the news at all. I never know really what's going on, but obviously Syria has been so much in the news, you can't help it. So a few weeks ago, the world was going to end because we were going to have World War III. Now it's not in the news anymore somehow. And the newspapers don't apologize about how much they scared you. They don't care. They just move on. They have to sell newspapers. So it's never worth getting involved in the flavor of the day political debate because just doesn't matter. The world is going to keep continuing. It's eventually going to, you know, merge into the sun, but none of these issues will be important then.
You say people should give up control and get smarter. I thought that was an interesting comment. What do you mean by that?
Well, if I try to control what people think of me, I'm going to just end up fighting all the time because no matter what you say, half of people are not going to like what you say, particularly if you're mildly polarizing, or even if you want to help people, just a lot of people don't want to be helped. They get very angry about it. So you can't fight, you can't control, you can't do anything to try to change people. What I tend to do is I say, this is what worked for me. It may not work for you, it may not work for anybody else on the entire planet, but this set of things that happened worked for me. If when I wanted to be happier, when I wanted to make more money, when I wanted to find some peace in my life, when I wanted to meet a woman, you could try it or not. Up to you. I'm not forcing anybody. And by that, by doing that, I let other people have the choice to choose themselves, and I'm happy. They can listen or not.
Big weight off of your shoulders, for sure.
Yeah, the brain is one of your heaviest, you know, organs of the body. So as the less things I can put in my brain, the less weight on my shoulders.
I've gotten a vicarious thrill seeing how you bypass mainstream publishing companies, because I managed to do the same thing at a time clear back in the 70s when it totally shocked the publishing world. Of course, there was no internet. I did it through full-page newspaper advertising, and everybody thought I was insane, and there was 100% unanimity that I was going to totally strike out and fail. And like you described earlier, I did it all by myself. I had this little office that this guy was letting me use for free, and I tell the story in detail in one of my writings. But when I read about Jeff Bezos being down on his knees originally and wrapping books and taking them to the post office, it really struck a bell, because here I was 20 years earlier doing the exact same thing, and a book that was rejected by 23 publishers. I didn't know anything about self-publishing, but I had to publish it myself. I felt I had to publish it myself. And I learned as I went along. I made 10,000 mistakes. And a year and a half after I did it, it was a New York Times number one bestseller. So
that's great.
If someone has a book idea, James, or a book already written, in this day and age, what would you advise them to self-publish? And if so, they all want to know the same thing. How do you go about it?
Well, number one, I would definitely advise them to self-publish, because the only reason to go with a publisher is to get an advance. But an advance is, the advances in general are going so low that it will never actually compensate you for your time. Like, let's say you're a novelist, and you're let's say Simon & Schuster wants to publish your first novel. Okay, they'll write you a $5,000 check for 6,000 hours worth of work that you're going to do. So it's never worth it, the advance. So you absolutely should self-publish, because you can just load it up right now to Amazon. Speaking of Jeff Bezos, you can just load it up to createspace.com and kdp.amazon.com, and now you're published. And now the question is, well, the author will typically say, well, publishers put me in the bookstore and they market me. Two answers to that. One is, they don't actually put you in the bookstore. They only put bestsellers in the bookstore. And number two, they actually don't market you. They have no clue how to market in today's
day. Zero marketing. They do zero marketing, I can tell you from experience. Zero.
Zero. And I don't know if they do this on purpose or not, but they lie to you about how they market. They just – actually, I do have evidence that they blatantly lie to you, but I won't get into that whole story. But so you have to do your own marketing anyway. And so what do? Well, you need to build a presence out there. Like, you have a blog, or you go on Facebook, or you go on Twitter, or you know, in general, you guest blog for other popular sites. Like, you have to work hard to build your own, call it personal brand. I hate to use that phrase, but you have to kind of get out there and let people know who you are, because no one else is going to do it for you. If you don't promote yourself, no one else will do it for you. If you promote yourself, by the way, then everybody else will do it for you, but not until you promote yourself.
You know, having been in the public eye for a long time, I've gotten used to the fact that a certain percentage of people don't like what I have to say, and a large percentage, as you put it, don't care. I like to call it the Neil Diamond syndrome. It's been said that the world is divided into two types of people, those who love Neil Diamond and those who hate Neil Diamond. But guess what? The haters don't matter, because Neil Diamond still collects tens of millions of dollars a year in royalties from the people who love him. Do you feel that you finally reached a point in life where you are truly able to ignore the haters and the people who don't care one way or another about you or your work?
You know, to be honest, no. I mean, I still look occasionally at the negative comments that come up. It depends. Everybody's got their buttons that can be pressed, and sometimes – one negative comment out of 100 will press the right buttons with me, and I'll feel like, why did that person just say that? But I always have to back up and say, listen, I don't want to ruin the day or the week or the weekend. I need to ignore this comment and not respond to it. Just, you can't respond to a negative comment because that's just going to trigger five more negative comments. 100% of the time, I've never once seen a response to a negative comment trigger, you know what, I'm sorry, you're right. I've changed my mind from negative to positive about you. Like, that never happens. That's never happened in the history of the universe. So I have to be better at it. It's a daily practice, as I call it, to seek self-improvement on some of these things.
Final question, James. You say Woody Allen claims to only work 3 to 5 hours a day and has all this enormous success. Do you really believe the average person can be successful working 3 to 5 hours a day?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, look, most people think about the corporate world. Okay, most people don't work more than an hour a day. You know, they take coffee breaks, lunch breaks, cigarette breaks. They gossip. They meet at the water cooler. They talk about last night's TV shows. So the average person in the corporate world, I know this having been in the corporate world on several occasions, people work maybe an hour a day. You know, the rest of the time they're in meetings, which doesn't really count as work. So then when you're actually on your own, if you can have 3 to 5 hours of actual productivity, that that's 500% more than the average worker in America. You're going to get enormous things done. So, and then also people need to relax. You need to enjoy life. Like, life is not meant to be, you know, to work 12 hours a day. You know, hunters and gatherers, you know, 40,000 years ago, they weren't, like, gathering 12 hours a day. They'd gather, they'd eat, and then they'd rest and relax a little bit.
Great stuff. James, thanks so much for visiting with us today, and I wish you continued success in all of your remarkable endeavors.
Robert, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a real honor.